Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Please make your way quickly to your seats. We will run all sessions on time. And the reason is that concurrent sessions start at a given time. And to be fair to the speakers in the concurrent session, the sessions before need to finish on time. So I'd appreciate everyone's help ensuring that we finish right on the time shown in our program. We have from 11 until 11:50, and Terry and I are committed to having you able to leave at 11:50. And we hope that you enjoy the concurrent sessions. We hope you enjoyed the opening session. And I'm going to hope that you can hear this introduction over the noise of people still coming in. My name is Jerome Winston. I'm a longtime member of the AES, and I will have met many of you in many situations before if you too share a long history in evaluation. Our first speaker, I don't know him personally well enough to call him anything other than Professor William. Professor William gave us a real insight into the different cultures, or as I often say, the different evaluation islands that exist. And sometimes those islands don't seem to communicate very much with each other. What the AES has done from the earliest days of the first national evaluation conferences that Professor Anona Armstrong organized in Melbourne way back in the 80s, we have built bridges across the different cultures involved in evaluation. Our second keynote speaker today is Terry O'Brien. I'm not going to take his time or your time reading you about his background, but please turn to page 13 in your program notes and have a look at the wonderful experience that Terry is bringing to speak to us today. His topic is absolutely spot on for the question of how we bridge different approaches, helping evidence inform policy, the use of eclectic approaches. I'm sure you, like me, are looking forward to seeing what, from the perspective of a first assistant commissioner of the Productivity Commission, what does it mean to bring eclectic approaches to helping evidence inform policy? Please welcome our second keynote speaker, Terry O'Brien.
Thank you, Jerome. It's a real pleasure to be meeting with you here today on what's clearly a fabulous conference and one that I find really impressive, not least from the perspective of having recently attempted a very small-scale version of something of the same sort. Just a week or so ago in the Productivity Commission's annual round table, which was also broadly on this topic of evidence-based policy. Comments today are the personal reflections, really, of a new boy at the Productivity Commission. I've only been working at the Commission for about 18 months. But that's interesting. When you're in a new organisation, you try to work out what makes it tick and what's distinctive about the way it thinks and all that sort of jazz. And I also brought to the task a background for 4 years on the board of the World Bank and working closely with its independent evaluation group and the board's Committee on Development Effectiveness. So that really exposed me to some of the particular difficulties of evaluation and influencing policy in development, official development assistance, and you'll see what might otherwise strike you as a slightly quirky reversion to that topic at various points through my talk. I'll roam around these topics. I share with Professor Trockham an ineradicable tendency to wordy PowerPoints, but don't worry, I won't read them at you. We'll press along as quickly as we can under the whip of a very strictly disciplinarian chair. For those of you who may not know much about the Productivity Commission, it's a Commonwealth government agency responsible to the Treasurer and it's the Commonwealth's principal review and advisory body on microeconomic policy and social policy and regulation. We don't do macro policy, we don't do budget advice or monetary advice or exchange rate regime advice or gold standard advice or anything like that. The Commissions Act stresses three important principles: independence, including the independence to present our findings regardless of whether the government that commissioned them liked them or not, processes that are open to the public, and a challenge to look at issues that are referred to us from the perspective of the well-being of the community as a whole. So when I started to read into the evidence-based policy movement, I thought, well, this is interesting. We try to do this sort of stuff. What can we learn from this movement, and how can we help along the cause of better informed policy? The first thing that struck me is that the Commission has proved in practice to be a very broad church in how it goes about collecting and analysing evidence. Professionally, we're mostly a bunch of economists at the staff level, although our commissioners are a much more diverse group of people. And our work program is overwhelmingly defined by the Commonwealth Government. These days, it's very often federally oriented through the Council of Australian Governments, but even when it's doing something in effect on behalf of that entire group of state, territory and Commonwealth governments, it does so on the direct sort of reference through the Treasurer. And I've just thrown up on screen a list of recent inquiries that the government has asked us to do. And I won't read them all to you, but I just challenge you to think, well, how would you get evidence and how would you bring it to bear on this surprisingly disparate group of issues? You might even, if you were cheeky, ask yourself, well, how could you conduct a randomised controlled trial or an instrumental variable econometric study or a regression differences approach? You know, they're very, very general topics: paid parental leave, parallel import of books, problem gambling, conservation of historic heritage places, review of the Disability Discrimination Act. And the other thing is that, with the exception of paid parental leave, where the government said, well, here's something we want to do, how would we best design the implementation of it, all the other reviews there are after the event. So we didn't have the luxury of collecting data or defining what data was to be collected. We had to make do with what we could find, and we had to gain evidence as best we could. When you review how we've gone about these things, well, we have a very privileged working relationship with the ABS, and when we go to public inquiries, you know, industry groups and lobbyists and so on will obviously often contribute data of their own. Where data doesn't exist, we've commissioned surveys to generate data. We invite submissions, and historically and operationally, perhaps of greatest significance, we conduct public hearings, or in the case of commissioned studies, a slightly less formal round table approach. But we often try to sort of hoover up what the community perceives to be the evidence by asking them to testify and asking them what they think of each other's evidence, and publishing that evidence together with a draft report, taking comments on the draft report before a final report for government consideration. We perforce have ended up using a wide variety of evaluation methods. Just looking at competing explanations and ruling out any that probably weren't relevant because of timing factors or whatever. We do resort to quantitative modelling quite a bit, especially in certain areas of work. The work some time ago on border protection for Australian industries frequently used tools like effective rates of protection. We still use general equilibrium modelling quite a bit. But there's just lots of jobs that are given us for which quantitative tools aren't really terribly applicable, or if they can shed some light on the issues, they're certainly not decisive. Comparative case studies of what's happened in other countries, what's happened in other industries, any analogies from similar policy changes, and any well-tested applicable theories that might seem to shed light on the problem you're grappling with now are all methodologies that we've brought to bear. Just before leaving this slide, I suppose it's interesting to point out that our heavy reliance on public inquiry is in effect a reliance on qualitative evidence, but qualitative evidence that you can see, so you can cross-check if you think we've got it wrong, or we've heard somebody say something and interpreted it through the prism of our own model and made the wrong conclusion or whatever. So the transparency thing is a very important part of the process. As we looked around in this evidence-based policy area, it's interesting that back in 2004, we conducted the annual roundtable for that year on the topic of quantitative tools for microeconomic policy analysis. And that picked up on a theme I'll mention in a few minutes, where we have found a raft of new methodologies and powerful new evaluative tools and an ever wider range of statistics becoming available. Moving on from that, Gary Banks, our chairman, earlier this year gave an interesting speech on evidence-based policymaking to the Australia and New Zealand School of Government. And as I mentioned before, we had a little round table ourselves just in the middle of last month. Interestingly, our overseas guests at that round table were Jeff Smith, who's a sort of quasi-experimental econometric kind of guy, but a guy who's done a lot of practical evaluations, and Ron Haskins from the Brookings Institution, who is actually on the advisory board of the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy. And we also had local protagonists like Andrew Lee and Patricia Rogers and so on. So many of the same issues Professor Trockham was talking about, we had a little rehearsal of the other week. Gary Banks' speech got a lot of attention, and indeed it was reprinted by the Public Service Commission in its sort of executive leadership series, partly because it spent a lot of time talking about the practicality end of the spectrum of doing evaluation in government and making evaluation influential on policy. And that takes you away from the sort of highfalutin issues of methodology to some very basic issues of time, the right staff skills, independence, good resourcing, and a receptive policy environment. And I think it's those elements that sort of benchmark attention between government processes that demand ever clearer use of evidence and timelines for decision-making that aren't necessarily easily compatible with that. What do we take away in the Commission from the evidence-based policy movement? Well, I guess when you read into it a bit, the thing that struck me was its very broad commitments, which are first of all a commitment to an investigatory process or an evidentiary process, not to any particular methodology. There's a clear commitment to transparency, and the whole thing is kind of embedded in a democratic learning environment in the countries that have used this language most commonly. And it seeks to influence both the design and the evolution and the implementation and refinement of policy. But it takes designated policy objectives. As somebody at the round table said, slavery was abolished not because it didn't work, but because it was immoral. So, you know, somewhere or other you have to take your policy objectives. But the distinction's not entirely perfect, because often the use of evidence can help clarify what the policy objectives really are. I guess what I've said so far shows you that we're firmly, by default, if not by choice, in the methodological pluralist pragmatist camp. I just note on this slide, which I'll leave for your delectation later, just some of the international dimensions of this movement, including ones that might not strike us so much in our domestic context, and that is the aid applications. You know, the interest in impact analysis, aid effectiveness, the role of institutions like the Centre for Global Development, MIT's Poverty Action Lab, the interest of developing countries themselves in using evidence to shape policy well, the Mexican Progresa program, which is sort of conditional welfare payment system, is a really interesting case study. And some of the guys that Professor Trockham was referring to in the US, the Office of Management and Budget, as he says, is you know, fighting the good case, a fight, if sometime with the wrong tools. And I mentioned one of their little papers there, What Constitutes Rigorous Evidence. And that's worth a browse because it is a paean to the power of randomised controlled trials. But about the last 40% of it is cases where randomised controlled trials are not usable in government. And the thing that struck me when I read it is what a huge array of government services, including very important ones, are kind of off limits to the policy for one reason or other. You know, significant environmental change, major defence procurement, all sorts of issues like that. And that's without even getting into the ethical issues and so on. So even the protagonists, I think, for randomised controlled trials acknowledge some very big boundary issues. The aid thing is a topic I've found really informative because it is so hard. I mean, it may not strike us so much from the Australian perspective where our aid environment is sort of relatively uncluttered, but if we were Europeans or Americans trying to help development in Africa, you'd find a situation where there might frequently be 40 major donors to a single country, all wanting to badge their school program or their teacher education program or what have you. So the complication is not only to find out whether aid works, but whose aid works and how you operate in a world where whether your school program worked depends on whether the other guy's teacher education program worked, which in turn depends on whether the host government has the tax system that will pay for the teachers' salaries or not. So it's a tremendously difficult evaluation environment, and it's riven by the problem of externalities, that everybody would learn from good evaluation of everybody's aid interventions, but any particular donor has to incur all the costs of evaluating their own program, even if a lot of the benefits of what's found out flow to everyone else. So it is very striking in the aid area that you have seen the emergence of quite a lot of evaluation clubs. The Evaluation Cooperation Group for the OECD Development Assistance Committee, World Bank and IMF, the International Initiative for Impact Evaluation, which is another very interesting exercise I'll revert to later. Another thing just to touch on briefly is that there is a tremendous advance in the supply side of evidence-based policy. James Heckman was the co-winner in 2000 of the Nobel Prize in Economics, and in commemorating that award, a legal scholar, John Donoghue, reflected in a way which really struck me as a sort of working economist over the last 30 or so years. He points out that the single biggest advance in the social sciences in the last 25 years has been enormous improvement in the ability to analyse microdata. And some of those gains have come from computing power, some of them have come from the data sets themselves, but a lot of it has come from the emergence of much more sophisticated analytical tools, an issue which is not without its downside, because when you're using very complicated tools, it can be very difficult for the public to follow you, and there can be very complex disputes among the protagonists, and errors can be made and so on, from which fact I would deduce we need to place a lot of weight, and increasing weight over time, in the transparency of these evaluative processes. There are a lot of words in these slides, but this is the visual highlight of my presentation. A Doonesbury cartoon which does show how the the rhetoric of evidence-based policy has passed into popular culture. If you can't read it, don't worry about it, you can see it later. This one is a little bit clearer though. My question is, are we making an impact? And I owe Brian Head this cartoon, but I can't resist it, and we can all kind of visualise which particular wolf we most feel like in our working life as we howl at the moon. There is a fair bit of howling at the moon. The UK was one of the earliest movers in the evidence-based policy field, and just earlier this year, the UK House of Commons Health Committee concluded a study by characterising the UK situation as governments rush in with insufficient thought, do not collect adequate data at the beginning, do not have clear objectives, make numerous changes to the policies and its objectives, and do not maintain the policy long enough to know whether it has worked. And I read that quote to a kind of working level small group of Canberra evaluators 2 or 3 months ago, and one guy cried out, "Hear, hear," and started clapping. So I think this is a widely shared frustration. Is there an evaluation gap in Australia? I've taken the term evaluation gap from the development economics usage and the work for the Centre for Global Development on seeking to strengthen impact evaluation. But it strikes me that in a federation, we encounter some of the same externality or local public good or club good kind of problems that you see in the world of development assistance. You have a range of territory, state and federal governments all involved in an area of policy like education or health or overcoming Indigenous disadvantage. You have a certain natural richness of differentiation in policy and implementation. It would be interesting if any one party could properly evaluate what they were doing. They bear the full cost, and you might say the full political risk of a good evaluation, because hardly anything works perfectly. But the whole federation would learn from it. And it strikes me that this kind of economic explanation for the dilemma of strengthening evaluation in Australia probably has a bit going for it. Some of my colleagues warn me not to be too naive, and they say, well, look, we're in a 3-year electoral cycle, all our governments are on different electoral cycles, the people who are elected to office and the people who advise them are not there to conduct good evaluations, they're there to marshal the policy-based evidence that proves that their idea is a good idea. So there's all sorts of political factors at work too, but I do think there is something in this evaluation gap idea. And it's also true, I think, that from a Productivity Commission perspective, you know, the good old days were when somebody asked you what the appropriate adjustment in protection for a particular industry was, because that was a very well-bounded problem where a well-defined set of tools served you well time after time. When they start asking you about measuring and tracking Indigenous disadvantage or commenting on the workforce in the health sector and so on, these are much more ill-defined processes. But it is striking that the current COAG developments do stress better evaluation of policy outcomes. And interestingly enough, the 5 national agreements that they focus on actually are characterised in part by the fact that they're areas which have national public good characteristics or spillover benefits that extend beyond the boundaries of a single state or territory. And that, of course, harks back to my comments about the spillovers in evaluation as well. And the national partnership payments do exist to actually reward well-functioning policy experiments. States have been given a lot more freedom to experiment in achieving objectives. They're not bound to particular inputs. And this is essentially a performance management approach, which could be very valuable. Henry Ergas has written a nice little essay which says, well, be careful what you wish for, because when you set up incentives to do certain things, you can be pretty sure people will do them, so you better make sure that you've constructed the incentives to do what your outcome really is. And he tells all the horror stories from the UK of how, you know, setting targets for prompt emergency treatment in hospitals simply led to hospitals parking people in ambulances until their emergency room had cleared enough to be able to accept patients and treat them within the targeted time and so on. So if you think of this as a bit of a risk for where COAG is right at the moment, it also adds as an argument, I think, to be conducting better quality evaluations and learning better from each other. Well, we wondered as we led up to this round table, was there anything we could do to help this process along? We decided the world didn't need another manual, but we wondered, looking at the sort of policy frontiers of evidence-based debate, whether propagating some principles might help to carry the discussion forward a bit at the level of politicians, economic journalists, the general public, and in policy departments. And experimentally, we had a go at a list of methodological suggestions, which I feel a bit embarrassed about even airing to a professional audience such as yourselves, but they do include things that are more extensively discussed in Gary Banks' speech, but consider a range of options, try to make sure you know where you're starting from, try to get some baseline data, explicitly address the counterfactual, consider attribution issues, consider possible biases, and account for direct and indirect second round effects of a change. And all of those things are sort of lessons hard learnt from the trials and errors in the Productivity Commission and its predecessor organisations over the years. We are generalists. Our work program changes from month to month. We have to pick up new topics and try to find out what the established evidence is. And if we had an established working evidence hierarchy, it would be great for us. And it was an issue that was traversed at the round table, using as a prop Andrew Lee's possible evidence hierarchy for Australian policymakers. But the discussion at the round table, I think, was pretty much in the spirit of Professor Trockham's earlier comments that, first of all, it's quite misleading in social and economic policy to speak of the effect of a policy. Policy impacts are very diverse, and it makes a hell of a difference to a politician whether something is good on average or good on average but terribly unfair to a small minority in the community. You know, so you need to design examinations that tease out those sort of differences. Randomised controlled trials, I think people would incline to agree, were potentially a tremendously powerful tool, done well and in the right circumstances. And an interesting point that you wouldn't have gleaned from Professor Trockham's comment, people observed that so few randomised controlled trials are done in the social and economic policy areas in Australia that the boundary at which marginal costs and marginal benefits equated was well out there somewhere or other. If you could start with the right kind of test, you'd almost certainly be carrying forward human knowledge quite a bit. A point that's very important to the Commission, though, is that results from randomised controlled trials are sometimes insufficient by themselves, even when they're quite powerful in terms of their internal evidence, and that's because we're challenged, as you heard before, to consider the sort of community-wide effects of a change, and scaling and spillover or general equilibrium effects are often very prominent in the kind of topics that the Commission's asked to look at. People observed, as Professor Trockham reminded us, that not all RCTs are well executed, and that other methods can be quite useful. A conclusion that all shared was that there wasn't any single method of evaluation that was so powerful as to substitute for careful thought. I mean, especially when you go into some of the quasi-experimental methodologies, the policy import of a local average treatment effect from an instrumental variable approach can often be quite puzzling These things need to be closely examined, and again, I guess I come back to the leitmotif of transparency in presenting these results. I won't labour those nine methodological principles. As I say, they're obvious to you, but if I had my druthers and you could propagate popular awareness of just a few issues in Australian debate over policy, I'd go for challenging people to think about the impact of a policy relative to a counterfactual, taking account of the attribution of other factors that are almost always in play in complicated social and economic areas. If you think back to debates that we've had recently over petrol watch, grocery watch, Alcopops, all that sort of stuff, if you analyse it in terms of ideas like this, we were operating at a very kind of vulgar level of popular debate, and it would be nice to think that we could somehow or other carry that forward a bit. I don't think I need dwell on that slide. It's again a fairly obvious set of comments about just be wary of evidence that rests in part on a highly motivated group of protagonists trialling something with a self-selected and presumably motivated set of participants. And also look hard for second round effects. Institutional principles. As I trialled some of these ideas with my Productivity Commission colleagues, I got the sense there was perhaps more mileage in some of these institutional design issues as issues that haven't been thought about as much in, for example, Australian policy departments and so on. There are clearly very honourable exceptions like AusAid, who I think is probably drawing on international experience, thought through this stuff very carefully. But the notion that evaluation often has to serve dual purposes of an internal learning function and an external evaluation function is a real problem in designing an optimal structure for evaluators, and there are some very thoughtful examples. I'd point, for example, to the World Bank's independent evaluation group for how you can set up a body with the advantages of being an insider in the process, but with a great degree of protection from the management of the institution and a meaningful degree of independence and transparency and a process for dialogue with management and staff that unpacks the learning outcomes from evaluation. So there's all sorts of interesting things there. Just touch before departure on the issues of disseminating evaluation and pooling results and ensuring evidence is linked into the decision-making processes. Again, you can perhaps see the recurrence of this idea that in a federation like Australia's, we might be able to design systems that work a bit better here. Transparency, which I've already laboured a bit, is in our experience an extremely valuable tool in carrying forward policy debate and bringing evidence to bear. And we found ourselves in complicated areas like general equilibrium modelling, commissioned as we were a little while ago to provide some support estimation of scenarios to the BRACS review of passenger motor vehicle assistance and the Green review of textiles, clothing and footwear assistance. If you try general equilibrium modelling in those areas, it's a real minefield. If you go into it, you can emerge 6 months later with a bundle of experts all arguing about the parameters you selected in your modelling. And we found it enormously valuable to actually conduct round tables with relevant experts and sort of quality test the parameters we're proposing to use in doing these sorts of estimates. And again, I think referring back to that John J. Donoghue comment before, as evaluative methodologies become more sophisticated, you can easily make mistakes, and the test of peer review and replicability of results becomes more important over time, we think. Data, very nice to have data. Resource commitments to data gathering and commitments to making data widely available are probably deficient in Australia, I suspect. We have a fabulous official statistics service in the Australian Statistician, but we have heaps of administrative data that are very hard for other researchers to access. And indeed, another issue, if you look around in economic and social policy evaluation, is just how much of modern evaluation is conducted in the academy, not within policy departments and so on. So rules that create data and get it freely available with proper confidentiality protections would be very handy. Evaluation clubs are an idea I've touched on at several points, and they have the potential advantage of internalising the externalities of good evaluation across a federation like Australia's. Clubs usually have a constitution, or their members believe in something or other. Maybe the members of an evaluation club could align with the sort of principles I had up on the screen a little while ago. You know, that doesn't bind them to any methodologies, or it just binds them to ideals. And once you have high-level policy people interacting with evaluators in a club like that, you can get kind of peer review and peer support processes that can build evaluation skills and advance the quality of evaluation over time. COAG is a really interesting possibility for this. You know, you have premiers, departments, people, you have heads of treasuries, you have the key public servants from policy areas like education and health and so on, and you could have a very good interaction with the academic practitioners of high quality evaluation. So there's an idea, and overseas examples that you could draw on include some of the ideas which the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy has pushed in the US, which is that, you know, there be set asides in new acts which provide funding for well-evaluated state initiatives and reward successful outcomes with more funding. It's well worth watching the Office of Management and Budget in this, because it's going back several through several presidencies. It has been a driver in this area, and President Obama's appointed leader of the OMB, Peter Orszag, is on the record as suggesting some very good ideas here that, again, are not specific to the mode of evaluation, but are merely providing the resources for evaluation and some rhetorical support for higher quality evaluation. Often, I think in the US context, they will say parenthetically, randomised trials where possible or something like that. Now, you may or may not take offence at that, but I think even if you do take offence at that, the earlier stage of the process is a very interesting one. Again, the International Initiative for Impact Evaluation is a good example, where you have developing countries, donor bilateral aid agencies, and philanthropists like Google and Microsoft and so on, contributing funding into a pool which is assigned to proposed evaluations of emergent policies and used to fund those evaluations, and which proffers guidelines for what good evaluation should look like. So there's all sorts of interesting ideas out there, and maybe we could make more use of them in Australia. I haven't included references to those recent Productivity Commission jobs that I mentioned up front, but you'll find them all on our website, and some of the more out-of-the-way references that I've touched on during this set of comments are in the last couple of slides on the slide kit. So thank you very much.
If only all budgets would come in as easily as the management of time. Thank you very much, Terry, for helping the conference participants have the time to now ask a couple of questions. We have a bit over 5 minutes. We can take questions. And yes, come to the microphone in the center aisle. Are there two microphones? I can't see from here. I think there are. I think there's two microphones.
Hi, I'm David Roberts. I was really interested, Terry, in your comments about evaluation. A lot of your focus is on impacts and effects, and I think that's really important because one of the things I think we sometimes miss are the unintended consequences of programs. But I also see evaluation as being much broader than impact evaluation or measuring performance against objectives, and for me it's a really crucial part of the process is gathering the evidence to identify how you might design a program. I noticed you referred to one project where you did something along those lines. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit more on what happened in that, what sorts of things you were looking for when you did that project.
Well, I certainly agree with your comment. It's not a terrain that we've worked very extensively because, as you see from those examples, we're usually commissioned after the event for a time bound. It could be 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, public inquiry process and report on issues where we have to take the evidence as it rests and make the best use of it as we can from the best methodologies that we can. There are cases such as the gambling inquiry 10 years ago where the evidence on the extent of problem gambling was very patchy, and we commissioned quite a large scale survey which gave us the foundations for what was a pretty remarkable report, really, in hindsight, because it kind of inverted people's starting point presumptions that gambling was a sort of job-creating industry with very few social problems, and we found that, you know, that it was a valuable source of amusement for a lot of people who gambled very innocently and within easy bounds. But it obviously, in general equilibrium sense, it took money that would otherwise have been saved or invested or spent elsewhere. So its net creation effects were slight, whereas the scale of social problems were surprisingly large from some particular forms of gambling. But if you were to revisit that, you'd notice that the conclusions were heavily hedged about by uncertainties about the data, and we had to make allowances for the fact that people who were self-reporting to have gambling problems were presumably a tip of the iceberg, and there were quite a few biases at work into why the serious problem gamblers might not have been able to be easily contacted, or if contacted would not have been honest about the extent of their problems and so on. All that said, we recommended that there be some systematic gathering of evidence on these issues going forward from that 10-year-old report, such that governments could track whether their harm minimisation measures were working or not, or whether there were other changes worth taking into account. And nothing was done on that particular recommendation. So 10 years later, we're back doing another review. And if anything, the data field has become murkier than it was 10 years ago. It certainly hasn't got better. So, you know, you can try in these sorts of areas, but on that case study, not with a lot of effect.
Terry, just stay here. We only have now a few minutes left. I'd like to build on what you were just talking about, the lack of of data, the lack of evaluation built into the implementation of the policy or the programs or the projects that are going on. I can remember reading reports from our Auditor General commenting on the importance of building evaluation into the work that departments and agencies do. And that goes back to the 1980s and the early 90s. Do you see much hope for building more evaluation into the way government programs are funded and implemented so that you aren't faced with that problem as an organization, and there are many other organizations in the same situation?
Well, I do see hope, and the hope could be advanced practically, I suspect, through some of these ideas like evaluation clubs in the federal context, where people just became more used to and less scared by the notion of evaluation that would help inform more effective policies that delivered better outcomes at less unnecessary cost to taxpayers. My real dream, though, is much more fanciful than that, and that is a day in which Australian politicians would say, here's my diagnosis of a big problem we've got, here's how I'd like to try to solve it, we're not quite sure what will work, we propose a set of carefully evaluated trials and developments that will roll out different approaches within the life of the government, and by the end of our first term we will have zeroed in on the best functioning options for solving this problem at least cost. And you might think, well, yeah, good luck with that. I guess I first got interested in economic policy in the late 60s, and in those days Australian elections were a sort of shambles in terms of policy proposals and costings and so on. And if you look at how electoral processes and budget transparency and so on have advanced over 30 years, we've come a long way. You know, politicians don't propose policies that aren't costed or that aren't articulated in sufficient detail for at least to get a bit of a handle on it. So it seems to me that it's not unreasonable to hope for that next step where people could realise that overcoming Rossi's law is not a trivial challenge, and that getting things right with most benefit to the intended beneficiaries and least cost to everybody else is a noble part of proposing good policies.
Terry, it's not often that a person in the chair has the opportunity to propose a motion, but in situations like this, the chair gets to move the vote of thanks. And we are grateful for what you've brought to us. Maybe when some of us read that you had two economics degrees, we might have been concerned that we were going to hear a narrow approach to public administration and evaluation. We didn't. Our fears were not realized, if those even were our fears. You've reminded us that well-bounded problems are easy to tackle from a monitoring and evaluation point of view. You reminded me personally that I don't need to go to the UK to hear stories about what happens when narrow operational goals are set. Right in Melbourne, we have the most amazing stories about phantom wards and hospital bypasses, ambulances waiting. These are the problems of goal displacement and data gaming that we all have to wrestle with when we're doing monitoring, evaluation, and program planning. You've reminded us how important it is to look beyond the narrow definition, the most narrow definition of the objectives of a policy if we're doing evaluations. And I know from history, the Productivity Commission has set out to look more broadly. I would therefore ask everyone to participate in our vote of thanks and say, Terry, thank you for fitting this into what I know was a very busy week for you. And we appreciate your contribution to opening this conference. The AES, very mindful of financial responsibility, has asked me to present a small token of our appreciation, but with it comes our heartfelt appreciation.
Thank you very much.
We have a closing announcement from our sponsor.
Sorry, yes, one more bit of housekeeping. Unfortunately, Jim Dance is ill and will not be presenting the session on Friday, which was session 21A in the Derwent Room. But we have prevailed on Bill Trokheim, who's very kindly agreed to come and do a question and answer session on some of the issues that he raised in his opening speech. So that will be session 21A in the Derwent Room, and it'll be from 2:30 to 3:10. Cheers.
Thank you. We're now closing this session, and I encourage you to look for one of the concurrent sessions that's of interest to you. Thank you for your help in keeping ourselves on time.